You're listening to Food Confidence, a podcast about approachable health and imperfect food, all for the sake of the next generation. I'm Jennifer Bravo.
And I'm Andrea Paul. We are two non-diet health professionals on a mission to empower parents and caregivers in raising food and body confident kids.
You're listening to episode 2 of the Food Confidence Podcast. I'm Jennifer.
And I'm Andrea.
In today's episode, Andrea and I are going to sit down and talk about intuitive eating, health at every size, and why this is important. This conversation will lay the groundwork for our podcast moving forward, so we hope you enjoy it.
If you have any questions about anything we talk about on this episode, please feel free to shoot us an email at foodconfidencepod@gmail.com.
So today I want to tell a story that I recently heard from a friend, and I think that this story paints a really good picture of how diet culture has come to kind of influence us as parents, which then of course influences our children. And this story is really important because it really shows the distinction between intuitive eating and making decisions around food choices because of diet culture and fear. A friend of mine recently had her daughter's second birthday, and she brought cupcakes in to the school. And the cupcakes were like little mini Whole Foods cupcakes. They were like gluten-free, you know, allergen-free, dye-free, safe food.
So very respectful of everyone's, you know, allergies or intolerances.
Exactly. Yeah, they were school safe. And so she brought them in, and they were little bite-sized treats that she thought, you know, everyone could enjoy to celebrate the birthday. And the school right off the bat said, well, first we have to ask parents' permission, which is totally fine. But she said that half of the parents in the room said no, which was surprising to me. That kind of took me aback because, you know, I figured that if they were allergen-free and they were small bite-sized cupcakes, you know, why wouldn't they? But then I had to really reflect on that. And it struck me pretty quickly that it's because, you know, diet culture has influenced us to fear all sugar and fear foods, which is understandable. That message is everywhere.
It's so strong. So strong.
It's so strong.
Yeah.
But the reason I had to kind of reflect on why it really struck me so hard, and I think that the reason was is because, of course, as intuitive eaters, you know, children are naturally born that way, and so they tend to actually be able to self-regulate, but we don't really trust that process because of diet culture.
Right.
And so that was one part, but also because it kind of stripped the celebration from the room. And I found myself feeling, you know, sorry that all the kids weren't able to participate in the celebration, which is really the point. You know, the cupcakes are just the vehicle for celebration.
Right. The birthday is the event. The cupcakes are the object the way that we celebrate.
Exactly. And so that's one thing that I've been really noticing with diet culture is that we're starting to kind of strip away some of the community and social experiences around food that are so important in for our health outside of just what we're putting in our body, but for our emotional and our mental health and for feeling connected to the community.
Right. And like you were saying before, you know, this intuitive eating process comes very naturally to kids. I mean, every kid is born an intuitive eater. They are able to, you know, let us know when they're hungry, let us know when they're had enough to eat. But as we grow up, we get influenced by society and by culture, and those kinds of skills, that kind of intuition, and that ability to know when we're full and we're hungry and what we're craving and what sounds good, that really gets corrupted because of diet culture. And we end up not being able to maybe trust ourselves as much as we once did when we were kids. Yeah. And I think that makes it very, that could make it hard for parents to recognize that they can trust their kids. So I think that's kind of part of the reason we have this podcast, right? Is we want to help both parents, you know, reassure them and empower them that they can trust them, their kids, but also trust themselves as well. And that intuitive eating really helps us both sides, both kids and parents, kind of have a much more peaceful relationship with food.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's such a key word, is like the peace or the freedom that intuitive eating allows around food. And I think a lot of people, the misinterpretation of intuitive eating is that freedom around food will lead to a downward spiral, but the opposite is true, and that is evidence-based, that when we give ourselves unconditional permission to eat all food, and when we have that relationship with food where we don't fear anything in particular, we don't put anything on a pedestal, that is when we can make decisions truly based on what our body is telling us.
Right.
And kids are able to do that, which I'm a parent, and I understand why that you'd fear that would be true or not.
Right.
But the truth is when we create the specialness around sugar or the specialness around certain foods, our kids pick up on that very, very quickly. So then we kind of prove ourselves right. You know, if like, oh, this was a special food, and they pick up on it, and then all of a sudden they're treating it like a special food because that's how we introduced it, you know, whether that was verbally actually saying it out loud or just something that was implied. And so being able to kind of manage how we address food and come from a much more neutral state, and letting our children participate, you know, when it's appropriate and when it's presented, that's going to help us, that's going to help our children prove to us that they do have it under control. Right. You know, and then from there we can move on and make the decisions that feel from a place of peace and not a place of fear.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because I think it can be, I mean, I'm not a parent myself, but I've worked, you know, for a number of years with kids, and my impression is it can be pretty scary to be a parent. I mean, I'm sure you can speak to that.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of maybe judgment from society, from other parents,
from family members.
You know, it's hard to be a parent, and we're all just, all parents are trying to just do best for their kids, and I'm sure it can be hard to know the quote unquote right thing to do. And
I think it's particularly tricky to be a parent with the current diet culture, because it's a constant influx of information, and it's a constant influx of contradictory information.
Right.
You know, one day it's a good thing, one day
everywhere.
It's everywhere. You pick up your phone, you see a message. You're driving to the grocery store, you hear a message. You're at the grocery store, you see a message. It's everywhere. I mean, it's always just in your face. And I think that for parents, we fear, you know, if we're not making the healthiest choice for our child, then maybe we're being neglectful parents. And that is the scariest thing you could ever do as a parent, is feel like the decisions you're making are neglectful. And that's the way that diet culture makes us feel about certain food choices.
Right.
You
that
know, that
not
there's
enoughness.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's just like, I mean, it is, it's over the top. It's really hard and scary to be a parent today. So, you know, coming back to the point of this podcast and that story is just to say, you're not alone. We get it. And that's why we're doing this, is because we want to share with you the information that might help give you a little peace of mind, and will kind of just silence the room a little bit so that you have a clear space to think and make decisions for yourself and for your family, free of misinformation and diet culture. And so that kind of brings us to talking about what exactly intuitive eating is, what is health at every size, why is this important? And so I think this cupcake story is a good transition to the real statistics around chronic disease in young people. And in order of prevalence, it actually goes number one is asthma, number two is type 1 diabetes, and number three is anorexia. So quote-unquote obesity is nowhere on that list.
Right. Neither is type 2 diabetes.
And neither is type 2 diabetes.
And what is this? What is it? Like, a child is 240%
more... 242 times.
Times.
240 more likely.
To develop an eating disorder than to develop type 2 diabetes. But that is not seen in mainstream health messaging or health, you know, public health.
Yeah. I mean, that, even being in this profession, that statistic, that number blew my mind.
Oh, absolutely.
242 times more likely to develop anorexia or an eating disorder
right.
of any type than type 2 diabetes. I mean, I bet you if we were to walk down the street right now and ask somebody what's the most concerning chronic illness that children are facing, people would say, quote unquote, obesity.
Right. Except they wouldn't say it in quotes like we do.
So why do we say, quote unquote, obesity?
So the reason that we use air quotes around the term obesity actually brings us back to the origination of the BMI, or the body mass index. So body mass index was originally developed by, I believe, a mathematician or a statistician for insurance companies. And it was really meant as a way to view weight trends across populations. And so the BMI was really never intended to be used as a diagnostic criteria or to be used on an individual basis for, you know, diagnosing anybody with a medical condition. And in fact, I believe that, you know, there was definitely some question as to whether obesity should be even considered a disease. It is currently considered a disease, which is quite unfortunate, in my opinion, just because of all of the shame and stigma and, you know, negative health outcomes that it brings, that those things bring.
Right.
So
that's why we say, quote unquote,
obesity.
Obesity, because although it's been pathologized, the Health at Every Size movement disagrees with the medicalization of, quote unquote, obesity.
Right. So Health at Every Size, otherwise known as HAES, is a philosophy that really pushes for health improvements without pushing for weight or centering those health improvements around weight. So things like eating foods you enjoy, moving in a way you enjoy. A big one is respecting body diversity, because that is really underlooked and undervalued. We've had diverse body sizes for as long as, you know, humans have been around. So the fact that BMI really pathologizes and medicalizes varying body size is really quite damaging to both physical and mental health. And we see this laid out pretty clearly in the research, particularly in research that pertains to weight stigma and fat phobia. And really, you know, coming back to BMI, body mass index, it's literally just a measurement of height versus weight.
And I think there's another statistic around that where, I don't have it right in front of me, but it's like something like 40 or 60% of people in larger bodies have been misdiagnosed because of their body weight.
Right.
So what that really means is that the practitioner was looking at their size of their body and they said, well, first you probably need to lose weight before we address this, will help all the other things going on, rather than treat the actual ailment or disease.
Right. So yeah, I think there's a lot with weight science that we hope to explore on the podcast. Right. I mean, it's very nuanced and it isn't black and white.
No.
But I think the main idea is that, you know, weight science has been largely misrepresented in mainstream, you know, health and wellness avenues.
Yeah.
And that there is such a thing as body diversity.
Yes.
There's always been such a thing as body diversity. And we know very well now that there are significant and long-lasting negative side effects to things like weight stigma and fat phobia.
Yes.
And one of those big things is healthcare avoidance.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if somebody gets repeatedly, you know, weight shamed by their doctor, by, you know, other people, you know, it's no wonder that
they seek out help.
Right. You know, it's no wonder that they're not going to go and see, you know, their physician, because, you know, they'll get a lecture on how many salads have you eaten
totally.
This week.
And think about it. What's the first thing you do when you go to the doctor?
Doctor, and you get weighed.
You get weighed.
Yeah. And, you know, if you didn't know, you can refuse to get weighed at the doctor's office.
That's
something that you don't feel comfortable doing. So, you know, just say,
no, thank you.
No, thank you. I would prefer not to get weighed. You can also get a blind weight as well.
So if you don't feel comfortable refusing it altogether, you can ask that they keep from sharing numbers with you.
Right.
So that's an option
because
as well.
there are so few things you would even go into the doctor's office for that would require them to know your weight. So, like, maybe medication dosing, but I think other than that, you know, that list ends there pretty much.
And with pediatricians, too, you can ask them to, because they like to chart, especially as kids are growing.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
You can absolutely, rather than say, I wouldn't like to have my child weight, if you want that information, you want that charting and that, again, information, you can just ask that they write the numbers down and that they don't share it out loud.
Right.
And also make a point to tell your pediatrician and the caregivers there, the nurses as well, that if they have any concerns about weight or, you know, growth or anything along those topics, to bring it up in private and not in front of your child.
Absolutely.
And they will respect that. And if they don't, then it's time to find a new pediatrician.
Exactly. And I mean, and all of this can be done in person or in writing. I think as parents, you know, you absolutely have a right to advocate for yourself and for your child.
Yes.
I mean, even from my personal, I have been in a thin body and I've always been in a thin body. Mm-hmm. But even so, I remember going to my doctor's office with my dad. I think I was probably like in like middle school age, like maybe like 12, 13. And I was tall. Like I've always been a tall kid.
You're how tall are you?
I'm 6 feet now. But I remember the doctor who'd been my doctor for my whole life. I remember her saying like, well, she's not quote unquote overweight for her height, but she's overweight for her age.
Oh my gosh.
Right in front
of you. Can see my face, my mouth just, my jaw dropped.
And so like, and like in my mind, like I, in my, even in my like 12-year-old, 13-year-old mind, I was like, okay, like I know that's not bad. I know I'm tall. Like it would make sense for me to weigh more, but just hearing that freaking word overweight, like I'm pretty sure I was just so depressed for the rest of the day.
And
the fact that
out,
I remember that like so vividly, being in the doctor's office with my dad and the doctor saying, you're overweight, she's overweight for her age. Like,
what's the point?
What's the point?
Well, like, what's if the point of sharing that information with you?
It's just those things like that, that, you know,
those little micro traumas.
Right.
Yeah.
And no, and obviously, you know, I think I grew up in a pretty, you know, food positive household for the most part. But like, obviously I was, I knew at that point that like being in a larger body was not good, not okay.
Well, think about it. As children, we're always kind of looking to our peers to check in, to see how can we fit in and what's normal and how to find your community.
Right.
And so if there's one thing you can find about yourself that's different, you kind of fixate on that.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a human response. So why do we have to make that, why do we have to exacerbate that by calling out larger bodies? Why can't we accept body diversity and let our children see that, okay, good, all bodies come in all sizes and shapes, and that's one less thing that they have to worry about.
Right.
You know?
Right. And also all, you know, all foods are allowed and foods aren't good or bad. And there aren't, you know, yes, there are foods that are very health promoting and very nutritious, but really making room for all kinds of foods because food, I mean, everybody has to eat and we're going to be exposed to, you know, thousands of food experiences and they should be positive ones.
Absolutely.
I mean, food really should be, hopefully, be a positive experience.
Yes.
You know, you want those positive experiences for yourself and for your kids. So that's, I guess maybe that's a good segue into intuitive eating, that piece of it.
Yeah, let's share. So those of you who are listening to us who aren't really familiar with the world of intuitive eating, it's basically, it's an evidence-based approach to wellness that was, I guess you could say, really, it was created in 1995, but it's a human response to food. So it's been around for forever and ever and ever.
But the book and the principles and kind of the outline of what intuitive eating is was written by two dietitians, Elise Resch and Evelyn Tribbley, and the first edition came out in 95. And I think they're working on their 20-year edition. Yep. They're maybe third or fourth edition?
I think it's sixth.
Sixth edition. Oh my gosh.
I think so, but I'm not sure. I think that's what I heard Evelyn
say. So the new edition is coming out in 2020, mm-hmm. is what I've heard. Yep. And they're doing revisions now.
Yes, yes.
So it's really gained a lot of popularity. I mean, I say that I got into intuitive eating maybe a couple years ago, yeah. and since then I feel like it's really grown, but I've also created a very big bubble for myself. Yeah. So
that's right. Well, I mean, it's important too, just as you have to kind of identify diet culture and call it out, you just as equally on the other side have to surround yourself with body positivity, with health at every size, with intuitive eating, with all the things that help us be better off. But I do agree with you. I think it has, I mean, I've seen it hit mainstream media in the last year more than I ever have.
Yeah, I mean, if you Googled intuitive eating, you'd probably find some really good articles about, like, written by a variety of different professionals in, like, really big publications.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't know if New York Times has picked it up, but I know, like, The Guardian and Washington Post have had a great number of articles on that. I mean, it would be pretty easy. You'd be hard-pressed not find a good article on intuitive eating.
Yeah.
Which is really exciting that, you know, people are learning more about it. Mm-hmm. I think one of the downsides of it is that it does get co-opted on the diet culture side of things. Yeah. So people kind of slap a label on intuitive eating, even if they're still promoting weight loss and restriction and stuff, which is discouraging.
It is discouraging. I saw somebody on Instagram. I called them out, and you guys, it's uncomfortable for me. I've shared this with you. Calling out on social media has not done me a lot of justice in my past. Luckily, Andrea is forgiving enough. But yeah, so I kind of called them out. I inquired because I saw this duo create a 7-day sugar fix. And one of them, I wasn't too surprised, but the other one I hadn't heard of. So I clicked her profile. Mm-hmm. And the first thing it said was intuitive eating.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, 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 red flag.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't do that in this world. We don't demonize foods. Right. We don't do 7-day fixes. We don't do eliminations unless it's for like an actual allergy.
Right. Like if you're being supervised.
Supervised by a health professional. So
we don't do detoxes.
We don't do detoxes.
Or demonizing food or putting things up on a pedestal.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what this, you know, that's what these kinds of programs do. So, I inquired about it. And
directly to that person?
Directly to them.
Good for you.
I didn't get too much of a response, but it definitely got, I think, their wheels turning, and I noticed that they had started to follow some people in the intuitive eating world had tagged as resources after that conversation. So anyway, the point is that because it is kind of gaining some momentum, diet culture is catching on, as it always does. I mean, that's what Weight Watchers,
right?
They're not at the intuitive eating stage yet, but they definitely have been trying to strip back the weight centric approach and put more of a body positive spin on it.
Right.
But
the goal is still weight loss. Yeah. So that kind of precludes it from calling itself intuitive eating.
Or body positive.
So another podcaster and intuitive eating dietitian, Christy Harrison, who has a great podcast called Food Psych, which is
one.
Learned a ton from her podcast.
Yeah.
She calls diet culture the shapeshifter. So
ooh,
really,
I like that.
So really, like, it's shape-shifted over time and, like, kind of it's this moving target, right? Mm-hmm. So now, you know, I think intuitive eating, because it's gaining popularity, it's kind of people are jumping on that bandwagon so that they can be with the, you know, quote-unquote trend,
right.
Which intuitive eating is, I mean, it's, I guess it's trending, but it is not a trend.
Right. It's a human experience.
Right. And something that we can foster and practice, and we have that innate ability.
Cultivate.
And cultivate. Ooh, good words. Very good words.
I like that, though, shapeshifter.
Yeah.
That is true. And I mean, I get it. I understand why. I think about, we've been so conditioned to believe we cannot control ourselves around food, and that we cannot, we shouldn't be trusted, or we don't have the ability to make smart choices without extra information.
Right.
So this is the world we've been raised in. This is the air we're breathing, the water we're swimming in. But
we're, I think it's all... more sludge that we're
seeing. Yes, yes, seriously, an oil spill. So I think people are conditioned to not trust themselves. But a lot of people, I mean, I've heard this, I'm sure you have too.
Yeah.
A lot of people say they feel it in their gut. No, we're not going to use puns here, but they feel in their gut that that dieting doesn't work.
Right.
It's not for them. It's it doesn't make sense. It's counterintuitive, but it's all they know.
Right.
So it makes sense to me that diet culture would morph with a trending thing that is asking people to step away from diet culture. I could see how it would morph to try to say, no, no, let's stay here.
Right.
And why people would still stay within diet culture, because it feels safe.
Right.
There's control there that isn't up to them.
Yeah.
You know, so you could say, well, I'm sick of dieting, so I don't want to diet anymore, but I don't trust myself fully.
Right.
And I think that gray area between finding somebody, a professional who can help you become a better intuitive eater,
right,
or help you transition into intuitive eating, and trying to leave diet culture, there's that, that gray space that gets people caught, and that's where this morphing diet culture of quote-unquote intuitive eaters could exist, and how it could be easy to...
Right. I mean, probably, totally, like a red flag would be, like, if you saw an account or somebody who said, like, I'm pro-intuitive eating, but also here's a list of all these foods you shouldn't eat, and... Since becoming an intuitive eater, I find that I just crave vegetables all the time.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, I've really, like, rid myself of my sugar cravings and those kinds of things.
Right.
Like, those...
Still demonizing certain foods and idolizing others.
Right. And, like, turning it into a diet. Like, the goal of intuitive eating is not to, like, trick yourself into eating less.
Yes.
Or
healthier.
Like, or, you know, quote-unquote healthier foods. Like... It's about trust and
freedom
and recognizing that, you know, what you eat and how you move your body is not the be all end all of your life and your health journey. And
it doesn't have to be such a big deal.
Right. And I think that's kind of one of the things that you really, from our previous conversations before starting the podcast, that you, you know, the simplifying of health messaging and really how food is just food and can create, like, these memories and these food rituals, and, like, it can be very healing
without being a turmeric latte.
Right. It can be, like, healing, I guess, to, like, your soul.
Yeah.
Okay, so intuitive eating. So
yes. I think I always say, just as a quick, like, elevator pitch definition for intuitive eating, I always say it bridges the gap between mental health and physical health.
Mm-hmm.
It's the thing that brings everything together for a person on an individual level, rather than relying on external cues. You can rely on internal cues.
Right.
So that's usually my elevator pitch.
I think I say intuitive eating encourages each person to discover, like, enjoyable, sustainable, flexible ways to eat and move.
Mm-hmm.
While respecting their body.
Yeah.
So that really does speak to, like, both the physical and the mental health piece of it.
The respect.
The respect piece. Yeah. So there are 10 principles of intuitive eating in the book.
Yes.
Let me see if I can rattle them off.
Ooh,
without
let's
thinking.
Do it.
Okay. So there is: reject the diet mentality, honor your hunger, make peace with food, challenge the food police, feel your fullness, discover the satisfaction factor, honor your feelings without using food. How many is that?
I'm not sure, you've been counting on all different fingers. and also gentle nutrition is...
Yes.
Honor your body through gentle nutrition.
Respect your body.
Respect.
And exercise,
feel the difference.
And the last one is honor your health with gentle nutrition.
And that's last for a very good reason.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. So all of these principles, like, if you're actually really diving into intuitive eating, you don't follow these principles in sequential order. You follow it based on what is really speaking most to your needs. So you might be struggling most with food police, or you might be struggling most with exercise or something,
right,
in the sense that you've maybe been kind of abusing your relationship with any of these things.
Right.
So the idea is you kind of pick a principle that is really relevant to you and you start there.
Right.
But number 10, which is gentle nutrition, is last very specifically. And that's because in intuitive eating, and I think what Evelyn and Elise really saw was that, and I see this too, is people come to intuitive eating, but they say, yes, 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 I want this freedom, but what about health?
Right, right. And it's like, we have to, okay, we'll get to that.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we'll get to that. We can talk about nutrition, and we can talk about what foods are really growing foods, as we say, and what foods are play foods, but
right,
at the end of the day, we all already know these things,
right? Right?
Nutrition is much more simple than we've led ourselves down the path of. So really the idea is put it in the back burner, because most of us are probably doing just fine, and the other principles need to be tackled
right
before you can get to that point, right, without it becoming a new diet.
And first and foremost, I mean, that's why I reject the diet mentality as first. And
you, yes, that's
we,
true.
And we encourage people to go back to that.
Yes.
You know, reject the diet mentality, kind of check in with yourself, yeah, and like, where is the thought or this behavior coming from? Yeah. Is it coming from diet mentality, or is it coming from, you know, self-compassion?
Yes.
And trying to really be gentle with myself.
Yes, yes.
So if we get sucked back into diet mentality, then all of a sudden the way we are going to be viewing food and exercise and, mm-hmm, you know, our health in general is going to be seen through that lens of diet culture.
And it's easy to do so. I mean, mm-hmm, no matter how invested you are in intuitive eating, we still live in a world where weight loss,
yeah,
is the ultimate goal.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, you know, it's very easy to be every single day inundated with messages of diet culture.
Right.
So it's important to always check in, because you, yeah, can't turn a blind eye. You have to be very vigilant about identifying it, because messages, like we said, diet culture is a shapeshifter.
Right.
You know, the messages are coming through in ways that aren't as obvious. So you, right, have to kind of check in every once in a while.
Right.
You don't have to be thinking about it all the time, but it's definitely important to check in about.
Right. And you know what that makes me think of too, is that idea of diet culture being a shapeshifter, mm-hmm, is that going back to the point about, you know, different diets kind of changing their messaging so that they're not so weight focused.
Yeah.
But then we have this other thing, which is again a term that I heard by Christy Harrison on her podcast, which is the wellness diet.
Oh yeah.
So, you know, no, it's not about weight loss, you know, I want to love your body, that kind of thing, but it becomes more about, you know, maybe eliminating certain foods, mm-hmm, or harmful foods that we see, like, I won't get into that now, because
I know we should do a whole episode on the wellness diet.
Right.
I can speak to that directly, for sure. That's the world I came from.
Right. And I think the wellness diet, from my perspective at least, is not so much about like foods that are going to cause weight gain or weight loss, but, you know, there's so much fear mongering around,
yeah,
you know, things like genetically modified foods,
yeah,
and organic or non-organic, mm-hmm, or...
Yeah, no, there's a whole world,
yeah,
there,
yeah,
that is existing.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think we should definitely do a separate episode on that, because there's a lot to it, and
right,
there's a lot of shame that comes from that.
Right.
And that's a huge trigger for people. And parents. Oh, my gosh. So I think we should, let's do that. We'll make another episode on that.
Right.
So if any of our listeners have questions about the wellness diet,
mm-hmm,
or things that they think are, that we should discuss, we'd love to hear from you. So please do submit any questions for that one, because we're going to make that an episode.
Yeah. And we're also, yeah, you know, we're newbies at this. So we're kind of counting on people to help guide
hear
the conversation a little,
yeah,
bit.
Yeah. What do you want to hear?
Yeah.
So I think maybe the last thing I want to say.
Sure.
Before we maybe end our session today is a Brené Brown quote.
Yeah.
And she says, make the journey with our children. We can't give our kids something we do not have. We cannot make them more shame, and I'm going to insert diet culture, resilient than ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So
what does that mean?
What does that mean? It means we have to do the work with our kids, and it's okay to not have all the answers, and it's okay to have conversations and say,
mm-hmm.
I wasn't always doing this way, and I'm making this change because I recently read, listened to X, Y, and Z, and realized that I had learned,
mm-hmm.
and it's okay to learn and grow. And if we don't do the work ourselves, we can't possibly expect our children to be any better off. We have to share it through osmosis. It has to be truly believed in our core.
Mm-hmm.
So that's also probably why anyone can listen to this podcast. It's not just for parents and caregivers, but it's going to be information that we can all use, and we can all take something away from it on a personal level.
Right. So yeah, you do have to kind of do the work with yourself, you know, learn to trust yourself first so that you can demonstrate that you can walk the walk and talk the talk with, you know, the younger people that you're influencing, that you're raising, that you are speaking to on a daily basis, whether you're a teacher or a parent or a grandparent or, you know,
an aunt or anyone.
Anyone.
A human.
Any human. So
yeah,
I think that probably about wraps up our thoughts for our second episode. And if you haven't listened to our first episode, just go, you know, go back and listen. It's just a fun little explanation of kind of like how the podcast came to be and how Jen and I became friends. And so you'll hopefully just get to know us a little bit better through that first episode.
Yes. Look forward to episode 3, which is coming soon. We have some really amazing people who we are bringing on to the show and who we're going to have conversations with from varying fields. Mm-hmm. So I think, should we share who we're going to speak with next, or should we keep it close-lipped?
Keep it close.
Okay. So just keep an eye out for our third episode, and you'll see who we're talking to.
All right. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Food Confidence Podcast. I'm Jennifer Bravo.
And I'm Andrea Paul.
If you have any questions about the things you heard in today's episode or have topics you'd like us to discuss in the future, send us an email at foodconfidencepod@gmail.com or follow us and message us on Instagram at foodconfidencepod.